Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, and I'm joined today by Chris Cherniak of This Green Earth. He's sitting in for Tim Henney today. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Lynn, and good morning. And today on the program, we'll speak first with Jana Mann, physical therapist with Alpine Sports Physical Therapy here in town. She'll talk about a new technique she's bringing to Alpine Sports that has recently been recognized and certified in Utah to relieve pain. It's called trigger point dry needling. What could it be? We'll find out.
Yes, and then we'll speak with Bonner Paddock. He was born with cerebral palsy, or cerebral palsy, depending upon how you say it, and yet he has climbed to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. Paddock will join us to talk about the film Beyond Limits, which chronicles his journey, and about another film coming to Park City that will support the Ohm Foundation, which he is president of. It's a foundation which empowers children with disabilities.
Right, and finally, a conversation with Dr. Dennis Rosen. He's the author of the book Vital Conversations, Improving Communications Between Doctors and Patients, about the crucial conversations between patients and their doctors and how in a time of heavy caseloads and managed care, the real conversations have stopped and how to bring them back.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
The Glitterton at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitterton restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitterton serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
This is Bobby Trenzo, PGA head golf professional at Park Meadows Country Club and supporter of KPCW. Our Jack Nicklaus signature design golf course, golf instruction, clinics, practice facilities, and indoor golf simulator offer something for every golf enthusiast. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with Chris Cherniak, my guest co-host for today. Today we'll talk about a new technique used at Alpine Sports Medicine here in Park City. It's not quite manual technique, not quite acupuncture. It's called trigger point dry needling. And physical therapist Jana Mann is joining us to talk about this technique that she's just become certified to practice. Also joining us is Andrea Terwilliger, one of the owners and longtime physical therapist here in Park City. And good morning to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So did I get that sort of right? It's kind of like acupuncture and it's kind of like manual therapy, but why isn't it acupuncture? Because it does involve needles.
It does. And I think that's where the similarity begins and ends. We both use a needle. And I apologize to my acupuncturist colleagues if I oversimplify this, but our assessments, the reason we're using it, where we use the needle, those are different. You know, so an acupuncturist may look at your pulses, your tongue, use the needle along meridians, trying to channel that chi, get your life force in balance, that sort of thing. As a physical therapist, I'm looking more at where's your pain? What's your motion? Where's the dysfunction? I'm going to find those areas within a muscle that we can call trigger points and needle there with the goal of improving that function, improving that motion.
Okay. Andrea, what is a trigger point?
Say, for instance, you've got a little hot spot in your hip, in your shoulder, or something, I mean, that's really bugging you. It's a nice new way that I think we'll be able to treat the patients, but do a combination of treatments. So it's not the Jana and all the therapists I have working, you know, their hands aren't so tired maybe by the end of the day. But so she's the one that's kind of just gotten certified in this.
I mean, we've all felt those hard spots in muscles, mm-hmm. those knots. And those are called trigger points. And I could get really science nerdy on you, but essentially what they are is a hyper irritable part of the muscle that stays contracted or flexed even when the rest of the muscle relaxes. It's chemically different. It's electrically different. This isn't normal tissue. And what it can do, it can cause pain, either locally or referred. It can tension other structures like tendons or nerves. But more importantly, it causes that dysfunction. So you're trying to use that muscle to move, but part of it is already contracted. It can't help with the motion. So what we do is we take a really thin, solid needle, put it right into that trigger point. We try and get it to reset. It's my husband's a computer guy, so it's like pressing Control-Alt-Delete on a muscle, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is it, so you described a little bit the needle itself. Is it similar to an acupuncture needle? And is it multiple needles or just a single needle that's placed into the trigger point?
We do one needle per trigger point, and they're exactly the same needles. I mean, there's some new technology that's coming out for trigger points specifically where the needle's thinner but a little bit stronger than some of the acupuncture needles. But right now, I have acupuncture needles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it could be multiple treatments, multiple visits, or a single visit, depending on the results, you say?
Yeah, depending on the results. And I mean, most people, you don't just have one trigger point. I mean, usually if I'm looking at, let's say you have low back pain, I'm going to look at not just your low back. I'm going to see how are your hips moving? How is your upper back moving? How are your calves, your quads, all of that? So there could be trigger points in your low back, in your glutes, maybe over in that IT band area, everybody's troublesome area. And I might needle several places in one visit. And then with the intention of once we get that muscle to reset, we need to re-educate it. And that takes time. I mean, strength takes time. So there might be additional visits following dry needling in order to re-educate that motion and that muscle.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get a little science nerdy here, because I think a lot of people are interested. We all have knots and tightness in our muscles. And many people ask, you know, what exactly does cause the knot? And I know it's a referral of some sort from another area of your body where either we've had injury or, you know, overuse. People are very interested in what causes that knot.
Sure. I mean, it could be direct injury to the area. It could be repetitive or micro trauma to that area. And essentially what happens is at that, where that nerve touches that muscle, we get these trigger points. And for whatever reason, you get this pain spasm cycle. So that area of muscle spasms, you get decreased oxygen to the area. It starts to freak out. It starts to send out alarm signals, you know, to your central nervous system, which is response. And let's put some pain chemical in there. Let's put some inflammatory chemical in there. Let's lower the pH and make it really acidic and icky. And then that just feeds in a cycle to more pain, more spasm, and it doesn't release unless you do something. Why it happens, that's really the biggest nut that a physical therapist is trying to crack. You know, I mean, the trigger point dry needling is going to address the what, but the why it happens, you know, are you, when you're skiing, are you turning that knee in a little too much? When you're swimming, do you not have enough thoracic joint mobility, so you're overstressing your shoulder? You know, the list goes on and on and on, and that's why it's not just a one and done treatment. We use the needling to help decrease the pain and reset the tissue, but we need to look at your overall movement in order to establish what's really going on.
Talk about a little bit about the history of this process, because this is not necessarily just an offshoot of acupuncture or some other Eastern style. This is actually a Western style.
It's definitely founded in Western medicine. And really, the discovery of these trigger points started back in the 1930s. Physicians were noticing that there were consistent areas in everybody's muscle that were different. They didn't have the technology to look at them like we do today. But where the real pioneering work happened was with a woman named Janet Travell, and I forget her partner's name. His last name's Simon, so up in the clouds somewhere. I apologize that I forgot your first name. But they were John F. Kennedy and then Lyndon B. Johnson's personal physicians. And if anybody knows their JFK history, you know, not just the gossipy parts, but he had debilitating back pain. Mm-hmm. And Janet Travell would inject his trigger points. At that time, it was wet needling with either a steroid or lidocaine, I'm not exactly sure there, to help relieve his pain. But what she began to notice is it wasn't necessarily what she was injecting, but the process of needling it that resulted in his pain relief. So that's where it got its start. Hmm. My mom worked for the VA for many years. And in the 80s, she worked for a physician that used to do this all of the time. So why it fell out of kind of the physician's wheelhouse and has now entered the physical therapy wheelhouse. I don't know. To tell you the truth, I don't care because it's working and it's benefiting my patients.
Yeah. And a really great thing is, I mean, what it is doing is kind of mimicking a massage therapist's thumb or elbow in applying pressure and getting that muscle to, as you say, reboot in a way, or getting it out of the pattern that it's holding. And it's interesting, Andrea, because we both have the same nurse practitioner friend in town who has been doing the, as you say, wet needling with lidocaine for some time, just going in. You know, we all tend to have these knots right up here in our, you know, upper our neck area. And he would do that. So again, very effective. What would be the difference in wet needling using lidocaine or something like that versus just the dry needling? I mean, you talked about it a little bit, but
I think there's different certifications with actually being able to inject.
Right. Okay.
So by offering this service, we're just excited to be kind of, you know, catching up to the other states. And it was great that Jana got really interested in this and decided to get certified and went to a course down at the University of Utah. And so we've been able to add this to our practice. And so we just wanted to educate the community about what it is, and we're doing it. And to make sure that if they're having those kind of issues, Jana's the one to come see.
Right. And I would imagine that the other great thing is you can insert the needles and leave the patient on the table for a while that muscle spasms first, probably, and then relaxes. And then, you know, you can go and treat other patients and come back and... It's like magic.
Do an interview.
Right. In fact, everybody at the clinic who's listening, I'll be right back to take those needles out.
Just relax.
No, I mean, it depends on the muscle group. I mean, oftentimes the needle's just in there for a few seconds to maybe a minute. If it's more postural muscles, so in your low back muscles that are working all the time, I might put a needle in there and let it cook for a while. We can apply electrical stim to that. So if we're really trying to wake up a muscle, throw some electric stim on it, let it sit there for a little bit. But it's not intended to be, let's put 20 needles in and leave you for an hour and then come back.
We're speaking with Jana Mann. She's a physical therapist with Alpine Sports Physical Therapy here in town. And we're talking about a process called trigger point dry needling that she recently became certified. And you say that... other states had certified this process. I think you mentioned Colorado has been doing or approved this process years and years ago, but Utah just certified or will certify therapists in this process, correct?
Correct. So the last legislative session, the PT's scope of practice was opened and this was included. So.
Okay. And you've had this done to yourself and you too.
Yeah, she put three in my hip.
You put three in your hip. Mm-hmm. How did that go?
It was good. I mean, it's weird to have a needle being put in you. It was maybe a little achy, deep pain. Mm-hmm. She really stuck one deep into my glute, and I mean, it definitely made a difference.
Okay.
Yeah, but she's been practicing on all of us, and we're all getting stuck with needles at work.
I think like we might need to come in for a treatment.
Why not?
Chris?
Yeah. I've got a shoulder issue. Yeah, we talked about it. Yeah. So, but that's the thing. First, you have to do a diagnosis to figure out whether a patient is needle, I guess,
worthy.
Needle worthy. There you go. Right. I mean, there are some people that some issues that just aren't that this process wouldn't apply to. Correct.
Correct.
Okay. So you're going to sit down with the patient and have a conversation with them and figure out whether this would work or not.
Of course. And I mean, the best way to do that is to look at motion, get my hands on there, see if there are tissues that feel different that need to be addressed.
Right. Yeah, but
so that is the best way. Now, this is a town where people that have pain want to get back to everything, so they're doing anything and everything they can. So I welcome those people that just want to try it and don't want to sit down for the full thing. That I'm game to try if they're game to receive.
I'm sure there's a learning curve on your part.
Of course there is.
You're always learning. That's why they call it practicing medicine. That's
exactly
what one surgeon told me. That's why they call it practicing medicine.
Now, final question. Do you twirl the needles like they do at the acupuncturist?
We do more. I was taught more of a pistoning. So you find that trigger point, you get a little twitch and you go up and down. And you get a couple more twitches and you go up and down. And you maybe redirect it a little.
Isn't it great? Can you feel when you have your fingers on the needle, the muscle, like you say, twitching and spasming and then finally releasing?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It must be different than under your thumbs, you know?
It is.
That's great.
Is there a website that you suggest, maybe your website, but others that you might suggest if people want to learn more about this process?
Sure. I mean, our website is alpinesportspc.com. And then the course certification that I went through is KinetiCore, which is KinetiCore.com. And they have a whole bunch of information out there. Careful watching YouTube, people. I mean, there's some real sketchy videos of this out there.
Don't try this at home.
Oh, yeah. Anyway.
No, but that's important information. There are places you may not want to go to learn about this process. Some are better than others.
Exactly.
Okay.
Jana Mann and Andrea Terwilliger, thank you so much for coming in today. Best of luck with the new therapy. And Chris and I will be,
of course,
hunting you down pretty soon.
Sweet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Thanks. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be back with Bonner Paddock. He's the one who has climbed to the top of Kilimanjaro, even though he has cerebral palsy. A really amazing story. Stay with us.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, joined today by my guest host, Chris Cherniak. Our next guest, Bonner Paddock, was born with cerebral palsy, and yet has climbed to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. He's joining us now by phone to talk about that journey, but also to talk about another journey that he has made. He is the founder and president of a foundation called the Ohm Foundation, which helps otherly abled or disabled kids empower themselves to reach beyond their limits. And on September 18th, a film to support the foundation will come to Park City. It's called SOMM, or maybe it's just an acronym, S-O-M-M, and we'll find out. Bonner Paddock, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. And first of all, I want to talk about, I understand that when the film is brought to town on September 18th, that we'll see clips from your film about your journey up Mount Kilimanjaro called Beyond Limits. I saw a little bit of it this morning. Talk about that, if you would, first. What possessed you, first of all, to climb Mount Kilimanjaro?
It was after a fortunate passing of a boy that had cerebral palsy, much more severe case, and kind of drove me to say that, you know, I've got the gift of using my feet and everything and things that I complain about, the pain maybe in my leg. But, you know, looking at that and the opportunity, I guess, to go out and utilize these and try to break a world record that nobody had done that unassisted. So I said it's within a realm, a crazy realm, but I felt like with training and everything else, it was something, you know, doable and everything. And I was doing it to raise awareness of just more about the human spirit, about all of us, and just setting a huge goal and, you know, working towards it and then, you know, accomplishing it. But at the same time, raising awareness for those kids with disabilities. And then I have cerebral palsy, which is one of the primary disabilities that focused on the centers and charities that I was part of back then.
With cerebral palsy, you know, are there certain, it's kind of an odd question, but I'm wondering if there are certain types of things that you can do to overcome it in certain ways or to gain more control over your muscles? Or, you know, how did you do the climb?
Yeah, absolutely. It's primarily just teaching the muscles that are the parts of the brain that randomly die when the umbilical cord was wrapped around the neck. So it could happen to anybody having a baby. So to reteach those areas that per se are no longer functioning like a normal human, if you just do the repetitive training that would take to get to a big goal like climbing Kili or anything else, if you kind of put yourself in that sense, that daily task of training for it actually really developed and helped my cerebral palsy on top of, you know, raise a lot of money and awareness for kids, people with disabilities. So it kind of was the best kind of homework assignment for me, that it made it much more than just going to, you know, physical therapy, like if people hurt their knee or something like that in a sporting event or whatever else, they got to go to physical therapy usually. So that's the primary function physically that helps, you know, people with disabilities, just like it is if you hurt your, you know, leg or anything else like that, or occupational therapy or speech. So it's kind of one of those things that I picked something that was going to be very difficult for the challenges that I have. And most of us, including myself, kind of ignored it for years upon years. And so this was helping me kind of force it out in front and focus on the area physically of my body that I really needed to hopefully gain strength and ultimately confidence just in daily life that I could do something like that.
That's really amazing. Why in particular are you coming to Park City?
Park City is a great place. I work for a company called Young Market Company, and we are out in Utah as well. And the two gentlemen that run Young's Market for us up there in Utah invited me out, and this is the SOM, which is the screening, is about these four people that are attempting to become basically the masters of, you know, wine and everything. And so the documentary relates to exactly what we do for a living as our job, but the job is like so much more, and what Dave and Phil are is, it's kind of encompasses, because all of that, I fund the whole foundation out of my own pocket. So by working at Young's, that allows me to fund this foundation that's now grown. And it's one of those places that, going as a kid skiing and everything else, is one of the first places that we did a road trip from California all the way up, stopped in Brian Head, have done everything from Sundance to Park City to Snowbird. So pretty much had skied a lot, and it really helped me overcome my fear of kind of big sporting events or something like that, where it's primarily a lot of legs and core, which was very weak for me as a kid. Skiing kind of gave me that outlet. So kind of got a whole multitude of reasons why we're bringing it out there, but it has to do with Dave and Phil, you know, that work for Young's and have been such a big supporter of this foundation. They thought of this great idea, and that's kind of how this came about. And I love it up there. I was just up there already twice this year, so it's a beautiful place, and place I remember as a kid that was good outlet with my dad and brother to go skiing and those types of things. So it's a beautiful place.
All right. And have you worked with the National Ability Center here? I mean, do you when you ski, use some sort of adaptive equipment?
No, I ski and snowboard. So I can actually do both per se without any particular special adjustment to the equipment other than just the feet positioning on the snowboard. I'm a goofy footer, so but mainly ski now, just because as tall as I am, the weight on my feet hurts the arches on a snowboard. So it's primarily a skier. So that's pretty, I mean, those are the main areas of that I've, for skiing is, you know, the only thing I can do with my legs, I guess, for now. For snowboarding, I just can't put them in the bindings anymore. So.
Okay. Huh. That's very interesting, but pretty amazing that you can perform it. Now, it's making me curious about the different degrees of affliction of cerebral palsy. I mean, wouldn't it be true also that some that have cerebral palsy aren't able to speak as clearly, and depending upon, you know, where in your body you have the limitation?
Yes, 100%. So cerebral palsy is very across the board. It can be unfortunately as severe as someone that cannot walk or talk, and almost even eye control is even hard. So there may be the term that you may not think that per se that person is really functioning at any level, but it's amazing that once we've learned with technology to help them communicate by tapping their head against something, is amazing that they can now operate computers and get degrees when people mostly thought that their brain or anything else per se wasn't functioning at all or anywhere to that level to get a college degree. So that's kind of what we're trying to push out there. As someone like myself, who is very able-bodied and very fortunate to play soccer and everything growing up, to someone like that, I'm trying to hopefully say I do have the same thing, and we need to help those that have it much more severe than I do. And that's kind of the purpose of my foundation, is to help build those early learning centers and support other centers with specific services that will help get those people to their next level, you know, and it's their equivalent of climbing Kilimanjaro. I'm just fortunate to physically do that, but hopefully that can help motivate them to their next challenge.
Bonner, this is Chris. Do you have plans? What's the next project? What's the next time or the next activity?
I'm still recuperating from, I just recuperated in 2012. I did the Ironman World Championships in Kona. The first person with cerebral palsy to do Ironman in Hawaii. So my body is still physically recovering from that almost 2 years later. But I actually have a book coming out in March, March 9th. It's called One More Step, and it's going to be released by HarperOne and HarperCollins. So it's kind of a whole different challenge for me, but to go back through my childhood and talk about some of the uncomfortable times and everything else like that, all the way to, you know, going to Kilimanjaro and doing Ironman and now building centers and helping them from Africa to here back home in the United States. Kind of a compilation of those books of the challenges of life. And I wasn't always on the right road, as they say, and made some, you know, mistakes, but then have completely understood and got comfortable with my life. So the book has kind of been my focus since Ironman. And that's the next thing that's per se coming up.
Wow. So wait, you said it took you almost 2 years, or you're still in effect recovering from that Ironman event?
Yeah. 100%, yeah. So it's the doctors and everything at Ironman, like Dr. Bob, who heads up Ironman, they took pictures of my feet after the race. I barely made the 17-hour cutoff by 21 minutes, so I was out there for almost 17 hours. My feet and my legs are still recovering just because the muscles, cerebral palsy is basically, the muscles don't know how to really relax and contract and like a normal able-bodied person per se, and so it lacks blood flow and ways to really get in there to repair the muscles in the body as quickly as others do. So we knew that was a side effect after coming back from climbing Chile, that it took me 21 months to recover from climbing Chile.
Wow. That's really remarkable. And, you know, some of us complain about the soreness we feel a week after we've done a marathon or whatever. So, wow. I mean, how much you must empower these kids that you work with. Really, it's phenomenal what you do. So when you come to Park City, again, we're going to, if you could just kind of explain the program, because we're going to see a clip of Beyond Limits, but then we're going to see another, is it a full length, a feature film?
Yeah, so we're going to see, it's going to have an introduction, everything, I get to do some wine tasting and hopefully a nice evening out, but it's also, the proceeds are going to go to my foundation. But it's basically, yeah, the people that come to that, there'll be an introduction, and we roll a video that's about 5 minutes long. That an amazing video that when Oakley came out with my own eyewear, so we had an Oakley launch party, Embassy Sports, and this company called Red 57 put this amazing 5-minute video together that we will lead off, that pretty much blows the doors off of everything that's happened in the 5 years since Chile and Ironman and everything. It kind of encapsulates us into a pretty powerful video, so we're going to share that with everybody, then go into the documentary song, which is about these four people that are attempting to, their per se Chile or their Ironman is to become a sommelier, which is, you know, the highest grade per se of wine industry people. So anybody that wants to become a somm pretty much can do and, you know, diagnose anything about wines. It's amazing. Something I don't have. That's not a skill set I have. So I'm just coming there to enjoy that and support it. But it's phenomenal. I know it's won a bunch of awards, and I've actually not seen the film, so I'm looking forward to seeing it as well.
Right. I've heard a lot of great things about that film, and actually I didn't realize until you're just talking now that that's what the film is. So, again, it's September 18th, and now it's being brought here also in conjunction with the Park City Film Series. So, as all of our listeners know, the Jim Santee Auditorium is undergoing a renovation. It will be at the Prospector Theater, which is a great theater. They've made some upgrades and done a few renovation projects to make that even better. I know those seats are really comfortable there. In fact, I love seeing Sundance films at that theater. So that's where you'll be. And sounds like a great evening and plenty of opportunity to come and support this foundation. And did I say it right? Is it the OM Foundation?
Yeah, OM, and it stands for One Man, One Mission. Living Beyond Limits is kind of our tagline. But oh, I just had to shorten it instead of saying One Man, One Mission, because it's per se, I understand that's what I am, but it's more about the significance. So it's just OM. So it's hopefully like the logo and everything, it's inclusive of everybody, not just for individually for me.
Okay, gotcha. Well, Bonner Paddock, thank you so much for your time today and joining us. We'll look forward to your visit to Park City.
Sounds great. We'll see you next week.
All right. Bye now.
Take care. Thank you.
Again, that was Bonner Paddock, and he has climbed Kilimanjaro. He has cerebral palsy, but wow, what an amazing story.
That is. And I'm the triathlon.
An Iron Man.
I'm going to do an Iron Man. I have cerebral palsy. You know, I'll do an Iron Man. Let's give that a shot. I wish I would have had more time to chat about the training involved. You know, because there's recovery times, ongoing recovery times in training just to work up to it. And then he said, they say almost 2 years later, and he's still basically still recovering from that event. That's incredible.
Really incredible.
It's inspirational. That's even better.
That's right. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be back with Dr. Dennis Rosen. He's going to talk to us about the communication so crucial between patients and doctors. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank's Park City Branch, longtime supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your lending needs, from basic to complex loans. Our loan decisions are made locally. We have two branches in Heber and Midway and one branch in Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my guest co-host today, Chris Cherniak. Thanks for joining me.
Sure. My pleasure, Lynn.
Well, gone are the days when the doctor comes in and spends 5 or 10 minutes finding out how the family is, what you've been up to, and why you think you got sick. Heavy caseloads and managed care seems to have made those conversations vanish. But our next guest argues for the importance of communication between the patient and the doctor, and maybe how we can just be more efficient doing it. He's written a book called Vital Conversations, Improving Communications Between Doctors and Patients. And Dr. Dennis Rosen, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you join us. This is the title of your book really caught my eye, and I think it's probably any one of us who's been a patient, including yourself. I'm sure you are a patient from time to time. I want to tell my story, and I want to get all the facts across to the doctor. There we are up against this time limit. So talk a little bit if you would, about the challenges that you face as a doctor in, time and the conversation.
Well, there are a lot of challenges, obviously, and my feeling is that these challenges have only grown over the last few years. There's a lot of pressure on doctors to become, quote-unquote, more efficient, which usually translates into seeing more patients in less time. Likewise, we're being asked to complete a whole host of regulatory things such as filling out checklists and documentation, which without which we won't get paid, and which unfortunately eats into the time that we have for our patients. On top of all of this, patients seem to be getting sicker as they live longer. And that's one of the downsides of modern medicine, is that people are sicker. And so the complexities of dealing with them tend to require more attention and more thought, and it becomes very difficult to fit everything in to one 10 or 15-minute visit.
Right. And, you know, talking about diagnosis, you know, how has that morphed over the last several decades? You know, we fill out the questionnaires, as you say, and I feel somehow still, you know, reading something that I've filled out, a doctor is not going to be able to ascertain, no matter how fine-tuned those questions are, to diagnose.
Yes, and I think a lot of that, there are a lot of problems with these questionnaires. Obviously, one is that they're formatted in a way to identify certain things, but they really don't always get to the heart of what brings the patient in. So, for example, a patient may be complaining of some shortness of breath when climbing the stairs to his third-story apartment, but in reality, what's really troubling him is his concern that he may have to move out of his apartment and perhaps into an assisted living facility because it's getting more difficult for him to carry his groceries upstairs. Likewise, there's a big problem with medical literacy and general literacy. We're a nation with growing immigration. Many of the immigrants speak English very well, but don't necessarily read it as well as we expect them to based upon their spoken English proficiency. And there are many people whose English as their first language is just not up to the level that we might otherwise assume it is. And so I think we can miss a lot in these questionnaires. And one of the things which I really advocate for is people thinking ahead of time, perhaps the night before, about what they'd like to discuss with their doctor, what issues really concern them, writing them down, and ideally to have two copies of this list, one which they can keep in their hands as they're visiting with their doctor, and the other which they can hand to their doctor at the beginning of the visit in order to make sure that all of their concerns are adequately and appropriately addressed.
Dr. Rosen, does physicians in training in school, do you have classes in communication skills to develop that, you know, ability?
Yes, there are classes in communication skills. There are seminars in most medical schools, and I think people understand the theoretical importance. However, I think one of the problems is that when doctors complete their medical school training and they go into residency and their backs are up against the wall, so to speak, to complete all of the work that they need to do, things such as paying attention to good communication really fall by the wayside. I mean, there was a very interesting study done a couple of years ago in a large medicine program at an academic hospital where they looked at the residents, the first and second year residents, and how much time they were spending face-to-face with patients versus computers. And they found that the doctors were spending 40% of their time in front of computer screens, but only 12% of their time with actual patients, which is horrifying when you think about it. And now I think on top of that, we've seen in the last few years a lot more attention being paid to the importance of duty hour restriction and not keeping those 30-hour days that used to be bread and butter of medical training. But one of the side effects of that is that the work that needs to be done hasn't shrunk, but it needs to be crammed into even smaller time slots. And so many doctors in training just learn that they have to, first of all, have to get the work done. And they develop habits which are not good and which they then carry forth throughout their professional careers.
Yeah, I find that to be so sad. And I've noticed some of the ways in which I've been received at doctor's appointments is that it's assumed that you know nothing and you care about knowing nothing as a patient, and the doctor is just going to tell you what to do. And I've even, you know, I'm an information gatherer, and I think a lot of people probably are even more so in this internet age where you can go on to things like WebMD, which of course has an upside and a downside. But when you are informed, I don't know. I just find it sad that a lot of doctors will look at you as though it just doesn't matter. They don't want to know. And, you know, what do you think about this from your perspective as a doctor?
Well, I personally really like it when people ask me about something they've read on the internet or something a cousin has told them or a friend at work has told them, because that to me is a sign that they trust me. I mean, statistically, we know that the majority of people are going to Dr. Google for help in self-diagnosis,
right.
and they're acquiring information from all sorts of sources. And you know, a lot of that may not actually be true or be helpful from a scientific perspective, but nonetheless, it's real to the person who's read it. And so, but they're coming to me in order to help make sense and to get my perspective from my professional training and my experience as to what their symptoms mean and what they might expect to have happen to them and what they might need to do in order to get better. And so by discussing some of these other concerns, I feel that I've set the ground for trust. I feel that they do trust me, and they're not afraid of being belittled by me or mocked for looking up on Google what they've searched for. And I find that when I'm able to address their concerns thoughtfully and explain, for example, that taking inhaled steroids is not going to stunt your child's growth terribly, or it's not going to cause developmental delays or all sorts of other concerns that people may have, they look palpably relieved. And I know then that that's most likely going to translate into higher rates of adherence, meaning they're actually going to do what I've recommended that they do.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Dennis Rosen. He's a pediatric pulmonologist and sleep specialist at Boston Children's Hospital, also assistant professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He's written a new book called Vital Conversations, Improving Communications Between Doctors and Patients.
Okay, Dr. Rosen, who does a better job of communicating information to you, men or women?
Oh, let me guess.
Well, that's a great question. You know, I'm a pediatrician, so I tend to see both parents sometimes together. Sometimes I'll see a father, and other times I'll see a mother. And it really depends. It really depends. It's not uncommon though for people to come in and put their spouse on the phone, you know, speakerphone with their iPhone, so that I can get the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't. I can't generalize from that.
Good try, Chris.
Really? Well, then, do kids do a good job of communicating better than adults?
I think kids are really good at communicating, and I really try from the time a child is able to sort of to sit still and look at me. So from the age of 3 and a half, let's say, and up, I really try and direct my what I have to say to the child and to speak to the child. Even if it's an 8-year-old who's focused on his iPhone or reading a book in the corner, doesn't really want to recognize me, I know that they're listening and I know that they're hearing. And even though, you know, they're not going to make most of the medical decisions, if any, their parents are the ones who are going to say, you have to take your medications, you have to do this or that, you have to get this testing done. I really feel it's important for the child to understand what it is I'm saying, what the reasons are for what I'm asking him or her to do. And usually the children are really receptive to this, and usually they open up and they will ask questions and they'll ask for clarifications. And out of the corner of my eye, I'm always looking at the parent and trying to see whether they're nodding and if they're taking it in, or if they're looking puzzled, if they don't understand something, and then I can sort of try and redirect or readdress it. But I find children are really, really good, and they're very good historians for the most part.
Historians.
Yeah. So, for example, if a child, as a pulmonologist, I see a lot of children who come in because of concerns about asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, among the questions I'll ask are, do you get shortness of breath when you exercise? And so a child, you know, a mom may come in and she may not be at soccer practice on the weekend. She may not really know, or she may have seen the child playing basketball, but then he might say, or she might say, well, but you know, when I'm doing gymnastics, that's when I find it difficult. Or I'm okay when I play soccer, but when I'm on the ice during hockey, that seems to be a problem. And so that really allows me to get a better sense. And then, you know, then we can talk about what might make it feel better, and whether, you know, whether they've tried to take a certain medication before playing sports and if that's had any effect. And I mean, these are things that children are pretty good about opening up about. And if, you know, even if they don't know the answers this visit, they'll remember the questions, and they may be able to answer them better the next time I see them.
So you teach pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, and I just am curious really about, you know, the course that's called bedside manner, you know, or even if you even have time to have that course anymore, if that is a focus. To me, it's the most important thing when I go to see a doctor.
Yeah, I mean, I really agree. I really agree. I have not participated personally in that course. I've worked on some other things and other teaching, more of residents and fellows and a little bit of nurses as well. But I absolutely agree. And you know, it's not. I guess it doesn't happen too often, but it'll happen. You know, once maybe 5 or 10%, a parent will come in and they might say that they don't always feel comfortable with their pediatrician. There's something that doesn't quite, you know, isn't quite working. And what I tell them is that, you know, most doctors know their stuff. Most doctors, you know, have read the books and have done their residency and have their experience and keep up to speed. But if you as a parent or as a patient don't feel that you're on the same page, don't feel that you're connecting and share the same goals, that to me would be a reason to seek a different physician.
Absolutely. You know, just wondering also about, I don't know, about the time and the efficiency factor. You know, obviously this is a part of your book where the bottom line is you're not going to have 45 minutes to spend with each patient, although you'd like to. So what are the most efficient things? Like, you've talked about a patient bringing in a list of concerns and having it there and efficient questionnaires. But what else, when you're just talking to the patient, is an efficient way that you use that the patient can help you along with?
Well, so what I always try and think about is how I could extend the power of the visit beyond the confines of the visit. Now, I happen to be fortunate in that as a pediatric subspecialist, I generally have half an hour to spend with my return patients and a full hour for my new patients. So I do have time to talk. But still, you know, there's a lot going on, a lot of things that need to be talked about. One thing which I've really started to focus in on is to provide handouts. And I'd say about half of the visits, when there are changes or things that need to be done, testing or things brought in from other doctors, et cetera, I will sit down, I will make up a list. I'll just open up a Word document and type up the things that, you know, the homework sheet that they need to do, and then I'll print it out because my handwriting is awful, and I'll review it with the parents and make sure they understand exactly what they need to do. Likewise, if I'm making changes to medications, I will print out a handout explaining what might be a sign that this was premature, that maybe the child needs to go back on the medications which I've taken them off of. Likewise, if I'm putting them on chronic control medications, we have standardized handouts that I give. So these are all things which I think are really, really helpful. Another is I am very pleased when patients come in with two adults as opposed to one adult. And I find that note-taking is very helpful. Obviously, if a patient can take notes for her or himself, that's great. But sometimes there's a lot going on and there's a lot of emotions flying, and it's just hard to concentrate on everything, and maybe they're in pain or whatever. So having somebody take notes. Another thing which I think is coming, although we still have a ways to go for all sorts of reasons, is utilizing information technology, which we have available, to really make the visit at the encounter at the physician's office a much more valuable one. So, for example, we might have a person coming in and being screened for their health literacy, and if they do have identifiable problems, having somebody assist them with information collection, which is important but doesn't necessarily need to be done by me and take up the face time I have with the patient. They could fill out concerns. We could have them watch videos about specific ailments that they have, and follow up with videos about specific testing. For example, if they need to undergo a colonoscopy, it would explain exactly what needs to be done and could be watched 4 or 5 times until it was all clear.
Is there a good website, maybe besides yours, that you would recommend people visit to better educate themselves? And your book, too. But if they could go online and learn a little bit more about how to improve their communication skills, do you recommend one or two?
Well, I don't actually have, you know, recommendations for that in terms of where, you know, I think there are things that can be done by patients to improve the communication with their doctors and from their doctors to them, by doctors and by the system at all. And so I think, because I think there are problems within our medical system which predispose people working in it and interacting in it to communicate poorly. And so I think all three groups, patients, doctors, and systems designers, need to think about this from different angles. So, for example, the AHRQ has a really good website, www.ahrq.gov, which has all sorts of suggestions for patients who want to prepare for doctor's visits, you know, things that they need to talk about with their doctors if they're being prescribed new medications, that sort of thing. In terms of physicians, there's a growing number of groups and workshops that really try and focus in on helping people develop better skills. It, certainly, you know, you had asked about, or Lynn, you had asked about the bedside manner course. At my hospital, at Boston Children's Hospital, there are a number of groups that are doing simulation exercises where we have professional actors actually playing the roles of patients and of families, because we're a pediatric hospital, in which they, and we can ask the actors to ratchet up the anxiety or the hostility or their, you know, lack of comprehension or whatever, in order to really put the trainees on the spot, and we watch it through feeded videos, and then we can go back and we can discuss what went right and what went wrong. And so that's a really good modality, which we've, at my hospital, have been using a lot of.
Well, it's a heartening conversation. I like that we've been able to speak with you this morning. The book is Vital Conversations, Improving Communications Between Doctors and Patients. And Dr. Dennis Rosen of Boston's Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Pleasure being with you.
Thanks. And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Want to thank our guests today, Jana Mann and Andrea Terwilliger, physical therapist from Alpine Sports Medicine. Also Bonner Paddock coming to town on September 18th with his film Beyond Limits and also the film Sommelier. And Dr. Dennis Rosen, of course. And you thank our underwriters. Where are they? Park City Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club.
And I do have something to say. We want to welcome a new program to our 9 o'clock public affairs lineup on KPCW. We've been running our summer replacement show, Mountain Summer, with John Wells and several guest co-hosts, but summer's over.
No, it's not. It's back.
Okay, whatever you say, Lynn. But summer's over, and our new Friday morning show, The Morning Mix, begins this Friday. John is teaming up with Peggy Ijams, a familiar voice from formerly on Salt Lake City Radio, to create a fun new show focusing on weekend events, food, outdoor sports, and whatever else they find interesting. So join Peggy and John this Friday for the premiere of The Morning Mix.
Okay, so that's Friday, but tomorrow at 9 a.m., Cool Science Radio, John Wells and I will speak about cloud computing, a $10 million grant just recently granted to the University of Utah for just more exploration.
Research of
cloud computing. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's different than clouds. Tune in and you'll find out.
Okay.
Also, we'll talk to the author, Christian Rutter, of the book Dataclysm, about big data. We'll also talk about that gene, that mutation that allows people to live at, say, 20,000 feet.
Ah.
That's all coming up on Cool Science Radio tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.